Good morning, everyone. I'm Representative Jim Dabney. I have the privilege of chairing the House K-12 Education Finance Committee. This is an informational interim joint hearing of the Education Policy and Education Finance Division, along with some guests from the Early Childhood Division as well. Since this is an informal informational hearing, no official action will be taken today. This is part of a series of three hearings. Our first one was yesterday, all looking at the experience of distance learning these past few months, given the pandemic, and then looking towards what can we learn from that experience towards the fall and whatever the situation for schools may be at that time. As many of you know, if not all, the Department of Education has laid out three different possible scenarios for school in the fall, everything from traditional full-on teachers and classrooms, students coming in that first day all excited, to continuation of distance learning as we've experienced it, or a hybrid somewhere between those two. We will be hearing from the department next week. Yesterday, our hearing focused on hearing the voices of parents, and particularly the ethnic councils who chose to participate as well yesterday from the Minnesota's ethnic councils. Today, the focus will be on teachers, school support personnel, and bus operators who play a critical role in education every day, but particularly during the pandemic, a more unique role than they have in the past. So invite members to focus comments as well as testifiers on the experience of distance learning and concerns or suggestions you might have for the 2021 school year. This hearing will be scheduled much as yesterday's was. We will allow testifiers in succession time to testify. We'll ask members to hold their questions to the end. Representative Joachim, would you like to share any opening comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I just want to thank the testifiers that are here today. You do work in our schools every day and deliver for our kids, and at the end of last school year, you had to pivot to distance learning, and a lot of you had to learn new jobs and do new duties, and I want to thank you for all the hard work that you put in, and I'm looking forward to hearing your voices today.
Thank you, Chair Joachim. Mr. Peterson, would you be so kind as to read the names of the members who are present?
Yes, good morning. We have Chair Dabney and Chair Joachim here this morning. We also have Vice Chair Kunish-Podin and Vice Chair Sandsted with us. We have the leads with Representative Erickson and Representative Crescia with us. We also have Representative Barr, Representative Baker, Representative Bennett, Representative Bierman, Representative Christensen, Representative Daniels, Representative Damath, Representative Herr, Representative Jordan, Representative Juergens, Representative Katiza Watoon, Representative Marquardt, Representative Nornes, Representative Pryor, Representative Richardson, Representative Sandell, Representative Scott, Representative Erdahl, and Representative Wazlewick. And Representative Grunhagen and Representative Murphy share their condolences for not being here this morning.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. We're also joined today, as I indicated, by members of the Early Childhood Division. There's some overlap already. Some of the members Mr. Peterson just named also serve on the Early Childhood Division. But as some of the testimony today will be from early childhood educators, we invited the division to come. Thank you, Chair Pinto and Representative Morrison, for joining us today. Much appreciated. I'd now like to transition to our testifiers. Each testifier has been allotted 3 minutes to present. This is to allow the greatest number of voices to be present in our deliberations today. I would like to start with Maria Lee, a first grade teacher at Central Park Elementary in Roseville. Ms. Lee?
Good morning, it's Ms. Lay.
Oh, my apologies.
That's okay. Thank you, Chair and members, for having us here today. My name is Maria Lay, and I'm an elementary school teacher at Central Park Elementary in the Roseville Area Schools. I have been an educator for 14 years. In all of my years of teaching, I have never needed to do what I had to do this spring, need to recreate an entire curriculum for distance learning that is equitable and accessible to all of the students that I teach. The school that I teach at is one of the most diverse elementary schools in Roseville. We are a second home to many students of color. Much of the student population include refugee, immigrant, low income, and homeless or highly mobile families. Somehow, we were able to make it through the spring together. I spent hours not only making sure my curriculum was accessible to my students, but I also had to make sure that my students were doing okay physically, mentally, and emotionally. I found myself that I had to advocate for my students any chance that I got, whether or not it was in school or district meetings. While I do feel that my school district did everything that they could to ensure that every family had what they needed, including hotspots and technology, I still found that I needed to advocate to ensure that students had everything they needed. I cannot tell you the hours of sleep that I lost, needing to argue my point of how we can make things more accessible for students. However, I was often met with the comment of needing to do things for the sake of streamlining or maintaining status quo. While many of my students showed resilience beyond their years, I know that many students did not get what they needed. I constantly needed to remind myself, my colleagues, and my administrators that we are living in a pandemic. While learning was important, the well-being of my students was even more important. We must remember that we are battling two major crises in Minnesota. One is the pandemic of COVID-19, and the second includes the institutions of racism with the murder of George Floyd. Even with distance learning, business cannot go on as normal. During the school year, there was a student who was living with her mother in their family car with her siblings. Now imagine what this looks like with distance learning. We are expecting children as young as 5 years old to do learning that is typically expected of a college or graduate student. Students do not do well with watching videos and completing assignments. It was not uncommon for young children to turn in assignments as late as 12:30 a.m. That was my student, a first grader. Students who do not have their basic needs met will need to have those needs met first. When considering any type of hybrid method, we must keep students who are homeless and highly mobile in mind while also ensuring the safety of their health, as well as the health of educators working with them. Additionally, our students with mental health concerns and special needs also need to be taken into consideration. Students who require more services have even more work to do during distance learning. This includes students who require special intervention or had English language services. Distance learning doubled the workload for these students, or even more. This was challenging for teachers during the school year to create a schedule for students when they were meeting face-to-face. Now the school is putting it on students to access their teachers through distance learning. This was extremely challenging for students, especially if their parents do not speak English and did not have the means to help them. Students are constantly needing to bend. I've worked hard in my profession to create equitable access for our most vulnerable students. Whatever model we choose, we must make sure that we are ensuring that we are meeting the needs of our students who are most vulnerable. We must not make them bend, and we must create a system where we bend to them. Whether we create a means for a safe space for students to meet face-to-face with teachers, it must be done. Please also keep in mind the safety of our most vulnerable employees who are on the front lines providing food and emergency child care to our children, many of which who are also parents of many students. When making any decisions, please ensure the voices of our students, our families, our teachers, and the education support professionals who know and love our students. And I'm gonna speak off the cusp now, just speaking from my heart. Our students are going beyond what they need to do of the call of duty. And I cannot be more proud as an educator to see what they're gonna do in the future, but it's really hard to see that they are suffering right now. And we need to ensure that things can't be the same. If during a regular school year, they're worrying about their parents either being detained by ICE or that their father just walking down the street could be shot because of the color of his skin, it's a problem. So we need to see that whatever hybrid model that we do, that we are ensuring the safety of their health, but also making sure that we are meeting the mental health needs of them.
Ms. Lay, thank you for your testimony and your heartfelt comments. I appreciate it. Next, we have Maria Villavicencio, first grade teacher at Eden Lake Elementary in Eden Prairie. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning, chairs and members. My name is Maria Villavicencio, and I'm a first grade teacher in Eden Lake Elementary in the Eden Prairie Public Schools. As we dove into uncharted waters, the anxiety, the fear were heavy all around. I personally was on survival mode. The time to plan and prepare was definitely appreciated. It took every staff member in our building working together to get remote learning rolling. We are very fortunate to have one-on-one technology devices in our district, but for our younger students, the limited time, screen time at our school, then we had to transition onto full-time independent learning at home. Some households did not have internet. Some families were unfamiliar with the devices. Many of us were unfamiliar with the platforms that we were using to create and deliver instruction. The platforms kept changing on us. The parents were needed at the other end in order to assist and guide the children, many of whom were non-readers, some of them non-English speakers, and all of this on top of surviving a pandemic. It was amazing to witness the collaboration and the support from everyone during this time, knowing full well that we were all in this together and that our community cared was the fuel that kept us going. We prepared and delivered lessons in hope that we would reach all of our students, knowing that there were huge barriers that would impact their learning. We were all craving for social interactions and connections. And we had the fall and the winter to build those relationships, and that helped the transition. But emotions still ran high, and it was hard to watch my colleagues, my students, and my families struggle. My favorite part of teaching remotely was the deeper connections I was able to build with my students and their families. I met siblings, I met grandparents, many pets. I noticed shy students flourish in this type of learning. Parents were able to witness the amazing transformation as their child became a reader. My 2020 class will forever hold a special place in my heart. My biggest concern moving forward is that there is no one-size-fits-all model that will work. And distance learning just magnified all the disparities that we have in our schools and our society. Some questions that keep me up at night. How will we build relationships with our students and families in the fall as we start? How will we address the trauma, the inequities, and the aftermath of COVID-19? What changes can we implement as we consider the issues of racial and social injustices in our world and our schools? We did the best that we could with what we had during a crisis, but now we have time to reflect and plan, and we have to do better for all of our students, families, and school staff. No matter what model we move forward with, clear communication, time for preparation, appropriate resources, intentional training and coaching for teachers and families will be key. It is critical that we provide social emotional support for all. My biggest fear was and continues to be for everyone's physical and mental health, including us teachers and all the supporting staff and our families. I am ready to do my part. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Villavicencio. Next, on the list, I have Susan Summers, an early education teacher. Ms. Summers, are you online?
We actually have Cassandra next.
Oh, my apologies. I jumped ahead. Thank you, Ms. Burt. Next, we actually have Cassandra Shepherd, a social studies teacher from St. Louis Park High School. Ms. Shepherd, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Good morning, Chairs Dabney and Joachim and members of the committee. My name is Cassandra Shepherd. And I am in an interesting position because I am switching districts during this pandemic. I will be a social studies teacher at St. Louis Park next year, but for the last 3 years, I have taught social studies at Spring Lake Park High School. I have no idea what my new classroom will look like. I have never been to the school, and I will have to meet my colleagues online, virtually, and probably most of my students and parents as well. I also do not currently have any access to my district email, so I'm kind of trying to learn from a various sources on what the plan looks like for next year. I was very, very blessed to have worked in a district where all of our students have an iPad. So the access to technology equipment was not an issue for us. And they had been using some of the systems that we used during distance learning throughout the school year. I am also very blessed to be a daughter of an IBMer, which means I can troubleshoot technology pretty well due to that. My colleagues were very, very essential during this time as we bounced ideas off of each other and we supported each other with different ways to teach our students that weren't what we normally would have done in person. We did run into some issues, however, when it came to access of the internet. I had students that did not have any access to the internet, and we also had the situation with bandwidth problems because a lot of my families went from one person using the internet to five people needing the internet all at the same time. So things dramatically slowed down. And personally for me, I cannot name how many times I had to reboot my computer and send out email to my students, just a second, Schoology crashed again for me. I will be with you in an hour. That wasn't the only challenge, however, though. Some of my classes passed the maximum enrollment allowed because we were on online learning. So my normal numbers for students actually increased a little bit during distance learning. We tried to follow traditional school hours from 8 a.m. to 3:30, but we quickly found out that that was not going to work for the majority of our students. I had students that had to babysit siblings and help them with schoolwork during the day, so they were unable to make a lot of my live sessions that I had on Schoology and conferencing. I had students that also had to work. They were considered to be essential workers at their jobs, and their hours was switched from the evenings to the mornings. One of my seniors' day started at 6 a.m., and she worked until 3 o'clock. And so a lot of my students were most active at 7 to 10 p.m. at night. And I was commonly receiving assignments as late or as early as 3 a.m. in the morning. It ended up being a quiet benefit for my students during Ramadan because they were actually able to fast properly and get the rest that they needed. And then they were absolutely able to work at night. It did become a struggle for my students that were EL learners and special education students because of the stress of not having that face-to-face instruction and in-person instruction. I got used to hearing, I miss Ms. Shepherd, I miss school, I miss my friends. For my students, the last time we saw each other was Thursday, March 5th, because the following week we had spring break and we were never able to come back to school due to the COVID-19 outbreak. Before the Friday before spring break, many of my students had to attend a funeral for a fellow classmate that passed away the week before due to suicide. Something that I am still processing as a teacher, and I know my students are still processing as well. My school district covers Blaine, so it was the sixth student suicide in Blaine this school year alone. And then George Floyd hit, and then Breonna Taylor, and then Ahmaud Arbery. So it has been super challenging for me as an educator, and I can't even imagine what my students are going through. One of my students told me when he saw me, he was hugging me immediately. Skip the 6 feet distancing rule. So many factors have to be considered before we start the 2021 school year. Do we really believe that all students will be able to stay 6 feet apart during the school day? Will educators really be able to communicate through masks all day? Will our students keep them on? Will educators be able to have PPE available to them? With hybrid learning, who will be able to keep their students at home and who will actually have to send their students to school because they need the available resources that the school provides? Will high-risk students and educators be allowed to continue distance learning, or will they have to provide medical documentation in order to have that happen? Will students have all the resources that they need to continue distance learning? I personally have 4 high-risk people in my family, and me as a Black woman is high risk right now for COVID-19, so it concerns me to go back in the building. However, I do want to be teaching my students in person. I miss them like crazy. And these are some of the questions that I believe need to be considered. A one-size-fits-all doesn't work in the classroom for our students with their different learning styles and needs, and it's definitely not going to work as we consider starting the next school year. I trust that we will be able to come up with some guidelines and assist districts in providing the best education for our students this upcoming school year. And no matter what the school year looks like, I will do what I need to do in order to help my students succeed. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Shepherd. Before we move on to Ms. Summers, I'd like to welcome Representatives Edelson and Hewitt here, both who sit on the Education Finance Committee, and also Representative Boehner, who's one of our Early Childhood Division members. Ms. Summers, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Mute. Okay. Can you hear me?
Perfect.
Okay. Mr. Chair and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Susan Summers, and I'm currently serving as a literacy coach in early childhood family education in St. Paul Public Schools. I'm also a licensed parent educator and an early childhood educator, and have had the experience of teaching a birth to five ECFE class during the first half of this year. This class included several weeks of distance learning. During the last several months, my primary role has been to support teachers as they implemented distance learning classes while transitioning my own students to an online format as well. As Minnesotans rapidly adapted to a new norm during a global pandemic, the field of early learning faced a number of challenges as we sought to best serve families of young children. Like everybody else, in just 2 weeks, we developed and implemented an 8-week plan and entirely moved our classes online. Some challenges included helping staff through the extensive learning curve of new technology, ensuring that families had the appropriate technology for participation in classes, and determining the best platform to use for our unique class needs. Teachers were required to reframe their pedagogy to adapt to virtual learning in a field where hands-on learning and connectedness are so highly valued. Parents were asked to assist children in their early learning classes, teaching them the technology necessary for participation and helping to keep them engaged in learning from home. All of this needed to be accompanied by continuing to offer classes in multiple home languages and providing equitable learning opportunities and support for young children and their families. While challenges remain, I am incredibly proud of my early learning colleagues in St. Paul and across the state of Minnesota for the strides made in serving families virtually. In March, ECFE statewide was notified by MDE that continuing classes was optional and class fees should be reimbursed to families. Even so, 92% of districts continue to offer early childhood family education classes through distance learning free of charge. 98% of districts continue to offer programs through school readiness. In St. Paul, we were able to personalize instruction through virtual home visits, phone consultations, and creating family literacy packets to deliver to the doorsteps of hundreds of English language learning families. Some districts offered drop-in parent education classes that quickly met capacity and supported parents as they began working from home while assisting their children with distance learning. This continues to pave the way for the incredible support ECFE is poised to offer Minnesota families of children up through grade 3. This fall, many of these practices will continue whether we are in person or not. Having the ability to meet parents in their homes with evidence-based research, trauma-informed care, and support during deeply uncertain times is priceless. I had a late night virtual home visit with a parent in need of domestic violence resources and was able to provide a number of referrals on the spot. That parent may not have had the courage to reach out for help in a traditional class. We will be continuing the work this summer as well, offering a virtual infant class in St. Paul that will reach families without the need for them to leave their homes with a new baby. Moving forward, we love to build relationships in person, but we also want what is best and safest for our children and families. We were thrown a curveball, all of us, and we rose to the occasion, and we trust that we can do that again no matter what the decision is made. In conclusion, it is vital that ECFE continue the work of providing equitable learning opportunities and social emotional support for all families. When families walk through our doors, whether in person or online, they will find open dialogue, respect, and a safe place where everyone is welcome. These days are most definitely unprecedented, and families feel fear and uncertainty. All of us do. Building relationships that provide support in parenting, offering high-quality learning opportunities for young children, all while looking through a trauma-informed lens, makes a difference. Thank you all.
Thank you, Ms. Summers. Next on the list, Kathy Springhorn, a paraeducator in the Mountains View District. Ms. Springhorn, are you online?
Yes.
Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, chairs and members. My name is Kathy Springhorn. I'm a special education paraeducator at Irondale High School in the Mountains View School District. Before the pandemic, I supported students in mainstream classrooms who needed a little extra help with reading and science. I worked with students who were in special education life skill classes, and I assisted another set of students learn job skills so that they would be ready to join the workforce after school is over. Because of a decision by my school district to allow paras to continue to work one-on-one with students, so long as we recorded the interactions, that's what I've done during distance learning too. I met with students daily to help them fill out job applications, work on resumes, do practice job interviews, and assisted in discussions about appropriate on-the-job behavior. I've still had my daily UNO games with students in my special ed classroom. And this game helps our students learn their colors, their numbers, taking turns, and they're also developing their trash talking skills. I also spent a large amount of my time continuing to assist my science and reading students by breaking down their assignments into smaller steps through detailed emails or in online meetings together. I want you to know that the consistency we were able to provide our students has been critical to maintain and continue the progress that they have worked so hard to achieve. Across Minnesota, distance learning has been dramatically different depending on the district, building, and even the teacher. Paraeducators know how to support our students, and we should be brought in to develop best practices that can be used across the state. Distance learning has been especially challenging for our students with special education needs, and no one is in a better position to find and support those students than the classroom teachers and paras working together. It's not just paras who have important insights, but all school workers, and our unions must be included in decisions that impact us. Each workplace and community faces unique challenges related to COVID-19. To ensure that reopening plans address those challenges, broader worker and community involvement is necessary. Finally, I just want to say, I'm really proud of the work that I do, and I love my job. But school employees have not always been treated like the essential workers that I know we are. Being a paraeducator is a pretty good hourly part-time job, but it isn't enough to support a family. Most of my coworkers have to work multiple jobs, and most of those second and third jobs have closed their doors due to the COVID-19 pandemic. In our family, I have two college-age kids whose workplaces are no longer open, so we've gone from four incomes down to one this summer. Normally, the answer would be pretty clear. I'd work summer school, but in summer school this year in the traditional sense. And there isn't just easy work to pick up. So my family is sitting on the brink financially. I know that I'm not the only person in my union worrying about how I'm going to make ends meet this summer or if I'll have a job in the fall. It's the number one concern of 284 members. Because of a carve out in the state law, school district employees are excluded from Minnesota's unemployment system, while resort, golf course, amusement park employees, and private subcontractors doing the same kind of seasonal work we are doing are eligible. During the next special session, you should all consider to make sure that non-salaried education workers are eligible for unemployment insurance during the summer. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Springhorn. Next, Steve Miletich, custodian in the Orono District.
Thank you.
Miletich?
Yes, thank you, Chairman Dabney, members of the committee. My name is Steve Miletich. I was born and raised in Grand Rapids, Minnesota, a part of this great state, which I still love, by the way. For more than 20 years, I have been employed primarily as a school custodian. It has been my privilege for the last 17 years to represent the members of Orono's custodial bargaining unit as the steward. Presently, I'm serving my third term as a trustee on Local 284's executive board. I live in St. Bonifacius with my wife, Kim, and our German Shepherd. Since 2010, the number of custodians in Minnesota schools has been cut in half, Over that same period, the buildings in our care have remained the same size or have grown. In Orono, we built a new activity center last year, which added 96,550 square feet to our cleaning space. That center, by the way, during normal times, is open 7 days a week. The amount of work custodians were expected to complete before COVID-19 pandemic was already unsustainable. Most school buildings have 10 years of deferred maintenance. After students were sent home for distance learning, we disinfected our buildings from top to bottom. Once that was done, we completed environmental cleaning for the child care and food service that was continuing. And simultaneously began working our way through a list of deferred maintenance projects. That's what I'm working on now. The deferred maintenance will keep us busy for the rest of the summer. If Minnesota decides to do in-person learning or a hybrid model this fall, additional environmental cleaning is going to require additional custodial staff. Just as an example, districts across the state are finding that it takes about 2 days to disinfect all the classrooms with the current custodial staff. Now, that's about 30 minutes per person per classroom. This will also have an impact on passing times at middle and high schools, since even if teachers were able to disinfect their own classrooms, there would need to be 30 minutes between classes. We know from our union family and healthcare that there isn't sufficient personal protective equipment for those working in hospitals, nursing homes, and other healthcare facilities. Before schools are reopened, we insist that there be not only sufficient PPE for healthcare workers, but for school workers as well. Caring for students and the educational community should not come at the cost to our health and the health of our families. Finally, we must not try to cut our way out of this crisis. Austerity is not the answer to the challenge of COVID-19. Getting this right is going to take more resources, not less. There's never been a better time to commit to fully funding the public education system in Minnesota. We've been asked to do more with less since 2003. That wasn't sustainable before the pandemic, and it certainly isn't sustainable now. We owe it to our children's future to meet today's challenge. We are ready and willing to do the work, need the resources. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you so much for allowing us to speak today.
Ms. Milicic, thank you for bringing your perspective to the committee. Very important and very good to hear. Next on the list is Jillian Smith, a school counselor in Moose Lake. Ms. Smith?
Thank you. My name is Jillian Smith, and I'm a licensed school counselor at Moose Lake Public Schools, and I'm representing the Moose Lake School Counseling Association this morning. We all know that our students' mental health was struggling well before the onset of this global health crisis. And we strongly believe that our students will acutely experience the increased stress from this and related economic insecurity. I want to talk specifically about Moose Lake because Moose Lake is not different than a lot of northern Minnesota towns. We are a very small and rural school district with students in our district getting bused from as far away as 20 miles away. Many families do not have access to internet, either by choice or by just access because of the rural nature of where they live. Our teachers and staff did a fantastic job at providing multiple types of resources to provide high quality distant learning to our students this spring. And I'm so proud of the work that we all did at this time. As a mental health professional, though, I could see that our engaged learners in our typical settings did really well learning from home. But our disengaged students became even more disengaged as they were learning from home. And I spent many hours of my work week attempting to contact these learners and their parents to provide support and any type of help that they needed in order to keep on track, both educationally, but also mentally, and even making sure that they were getting their meals, their sleep, and all those type of physical needs that they needed to be taken care of. For us, this was a really big change, but we have to remember that for some students, distance learning has been the most tragic thing that has happened to them. I had so many parents email and call me asking about new behaviors that showed up at home or sleeping patterns that have changed. And lots of parents had asked for referrals for mental health support for me, but also for more support outside of school during the summer months due to this increased behavior and anxiety and just worry about the things that they were hearing on the news and from their friends and families. I'm at a district that does not have a social worker, and we only have a part-time psychologist. And unfortunately, I won't be returning to my position until after Thanksgiving because I'll be on family leave. And so many of my students will not have that first kind of mental health response here at school for the first 3 months. That means many students will go 6 months in our school district without any type of referral system or extra support outside of their family home for their mental health. And that's really scary for me, but it's also very concerning because this is the biggest thing that has happened to some of these students in their lives. I think that mental health is just as important as our physical health and learning. And if we don't have things in place for students physically and mentally, educationally, they will not be as successful as they can be. And so this crisis has just further exacerbated the need for additional resources to support our student mental health and their social and emotional development. I work with kindergarten through sixth grade students, and we sometimes forget how much support they need in situations like this. We know that the effects of the pandemic is going to be felt for some time, especially for students whose families have had job changes or different support in that way. We were very supportive this past legislative session of a proposal from Governor Waltz and Lieutenant Governor Flanagan that would invest $72 million in school formula-based student mental health aid to school districts to hire additional support personnel. Personally, I'm at Moose Lake with a rural school district and not a lot of mental health resources outside of the school in a local area. This is something that would be so beneficial and also crucial to the health of our students. Representative Davney, we thank you for introducing that first $20 million of funding. While we know that our state's financial outlook is pretty bleak right now, and tough financial decisions face you and our leaders in the next few months, we do believe that it is imperative to look at something similar to this ongoing. I want to thank you again for the opportunity to testify today, and thank you for taking time to listen to all of the different support staff and teachers and great staff that we have in our buildings that care so much about the children in Minnesota. I would welcome any questions that you may have. Thank you.
Thank you very much for bringing the counselor perspective to us. You referenced school social workers, and our next testifier is Christy McCoy, who is a school social worker in the St. Paul district. Ms. McCoy, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony. Thank you.
Good morning, honorable chairpersons and our committee members. My name is Christy McCoy. I'm the legislative chair for the Minnesota School Social Work Association. I'm also the president-elect for our School Social Work Association of America, and I have been practicing as a licensed clinical social worker for the past 16 years in St. Paul Public Schools. I currently work at Agape High School, which is a program for pregnant and parenting teen moms. So it's an honor to be with all of you today. As a nation and individuals, you obviously all know we are navigating two very significant crises that are resulting from the COVID-19 pandemic and also the aftermaths of the deaths of George Floyd, Ahmaud Arbery, and Breonna Taylor. These crises, as you've heard in previous testimony, have shed light on longstanding social inequities and injustices toward African Americans as well as other marginalized groups. In this time of crisis, the critical services that school social workers provide are becoming even more important than ever. School social workers, as you know, are highly qualified, licensed mental health professionals who are part of a continuum of mental health service delivery in our schools. And in the midst of our current circumstances, school social workers have been called upon to provide a continuum of support to our students, their families, and educational communities who've been struggling with increased physical and mental health needs. Whether we're talking about financial stress, as you've been hearing today, the death of loved ones, food instability, racialized trauma, as well as the ongoing uncertainty and instability. Additionally, school social workers have been critical touch points of contact within our school districts, offering support to school staff who have needed to address their own needs and distress during this time. Research has repeatedly shown that students affected by trauma, poverty, and mental health issues are unable to access learning and engage in school. And we definitely saw that through distance learning. No doubt, when we return this fall, all of us will have been impacted to some degree by these crises, but some students and staff will be experiencing the results of serious prolonged exposure to trauma and scarcity. Responding to this is something that school social workers have explicit and specialized training in, as well as skills to assess students and their families in accessing resources, support, and help that will enable them to re-engage in school. I just want to share a quick example. After George Floyd's death, school social workers like myself across the state, and especially in Minneapolis and St. Paul, rallied around to provide support for our students, our families, and our teachers by offering virtual listening and healing sessions to process the fears and worries and concerns that everyone was experiencing. And this was compiled on top of what they were already experiencing related to COVID-19. Now, my school is located on Oxford and University, one block east of Lexington. And by the grace of God, our building was not impacted. The buildings around us were. And one of our sister schools, Gordon Parks High School, many of you may know, down the street, just a few blocks from us, experienced significant damage. So with that said, in the midst of that destruction, the immediate response when other buildings, stores, and gas stations had to close up for safety purposes, that left many of my families and my teen moms without access to be able to get food, to get diapers, to get wipes, to get the formula that they need. So I ended up very quickly having to solicit donations. And with the help of my school team, the school counselor, our school nurse, we pulled together these donations. I have one, the English teacher, who's storing those donations as we speak because we could not get back into the building. And we spent then the very next week bringing out the basic needs to our students. And that was vital. So I wanted to share that piece, but I also wanted to share that, you know, as we look forward into the fall, and as our Department of Education and our districts are planning for a variety of scenarios of how we're going to educate our students in the midst of this crisis of COVID-19, if we need to go back to distance learning, whether that's fully or partially, it's important that we recognize that we did experience some successes, and we also experienced some very real challenges across the state. Some of the successes that I just wanted to share with all of you, and you've heard some of those today from the teachers that are with us and providing testimony. Many of our families just felt an increased partnership and collaboration with our teachers and support staff. And as was mentioned, as much as we try to stick to that 8 to 3:30 schedule, we often found ourselves working in the evenings to try to meet the needs of our students and our families. I also want to share that we saw an increase for some students in their own advocacy levels. They were reaching out in ways that they might not have done in the school building because they had access to us, whether it was through Google Meets, through email, etc. In addition, I also need to just have us all celebrate the incredible work that many of the districts did to continue to ensure that there was food service for our students and families. So many of our students rely on getting their breakfast and lunch from us every single day. And so I have to say that effort, in addition to the enhanced partnerships that we created with food shelves in each of our communities, really went a long way to try to address some of the food scarcity. But we also know that this is going to continue to be a barrier as we move forward. Finally, we saw increased creativity from our colleagues to address the social-emotional needs of our students, such as the development of virtual calming rooms, empowerment groups, and significant collaboration with our teachers. On the other hand, as I mentioned, we encountered several challenges from which we can learn and grow. In May of 2020, the Minnesota Department of Education surveyed the related service providers, such as school social workers, school counselors, our school nurses, OTs, PTs, speech therapists, school psychs, regarding the challenges to distance learning. And what I can share with you is there were over 1,000 respondents, and every one said the top two challenges were related to attendance and engagement. And there's a lot of different reasons as to why it was challenging for some students to engage. The impact of COVID-19 and the civil unrest following George Floyd's death has created needs in all areas of the lives of our students and families across the state. For example, as families struggle with loss of income, there's elevated household stress, often loss of food availability, and intensifying anxiety. We, as school social workers, have also seen an uptick in crisis mental health referrals, suicide risk assessments, and domestic violence. One of our board members shared with the Lieutenant Governor yesterday that typically in the school year, as a whole, she might have to do maybe 6 suicide assessments. But during distance learning, she had to do 8 suicide risk assessments. And the problem was, because she's in a rural district, there was nowhere for these students to go. They could not get them into the hospital. They were not taking the students. So she had to work with the families to develop safety plans and to do regular check-ins with those individuals to ensure their safety. That's alarming when you hear that within those last couple of months, she had to do 8 of those referrals.
Ms. McCoy, out of respect for the other testifiers, I do need you to wrap up. It's powerful testimony we need to hear, but we have other testifiers we also need to hear from today.
Not a problem. So just with that said, as we look forward, we must prioritize mental health support as well as social emotional learning if we expect our students to recover and regain the skills from the lost in-class instruction time. We also all need to dig deep to dismantle implicit bias and inequitable policies and practices and systems that perpetuate opportunity gaps between students of color and their white peers. School districts and educational personnel throughout this country are facing a challenge unlike anything in our history, but coming together as school staff and communities and focusing on the whole child and addressing systemic racial inequities, we can meet this challenge and potentially create an educational system that is better able to meet the needs of all students. So thank you for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Ms. McCoy. Next is Deb Murr, president of the School Nurse Association of Minnesota. Ms. Murr, please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, I am Deb Mayer. I am the SNOM, School Nurse Organization of Minnesota president, and the Health Services Coordinator for School District 196, Rosemont, Apple Valley, Eagan. Thank you, chairs and committee members, for having us here today. Some of the successes for our school nurses during distance learning included the opportunity to really connect with families, students, and staff surrounding education and hygiene practices during this pandemic. Hoping to help prevent disease spread, we communicated with staff and families about their exposures, the high-risk exposures, and determining if they needed to isolate or quarantine based on their exposure. We directed staff and families to resources and assisted them with resources if they were in a quarantine situation. We provided support at childcare for essential workers. We directed families with vulnerable people in their household to resources and help provide those through sidewalk visits, directing them to well childcare appointments. We're concerned right now about the possibility of other, for example, measles outbreaks if we don't get kids immunized during this pandemic. Assisted with dropping supplies and home sidewalk and driveway visits. We did make a lot of phone calls as well. Thank you, Christy, for talking about the mental health of our students. The nurses are often the people that see the students in the schools when they have tummy aches and headaches and are having some work avoidance. So we reached out to those students that we would generally see in our offices and made sure that they were having success with distance learning and tried to figure out how to support them. and their education. Things that I'm concerned and worried about, I guess, for this upcoming school year and what it might look like. I share with all of you, I'm certain, worried about student, staff, and community health and safety, and of course, health and educational equity. This COVID pandemic has just really is glaring us in the face, the inequities that we have both from an educational and a health perspective. And we need to get that figured out. I'm concerned for schools that don't have licensed school nurses. The licensed school nurses are public health nurses, and they can assist their schools and their communities with supporting students with critical health concerns and issues that attend school each day. I'm concerned, obviously, about the personal protective equipment and how we might support those students that have trachs, require suctioning, that sort of thing. We're assuming that they're well when they come to school, but obviously they are vulnerable. We are hoping that we can have face-to-face contact as well, but concerned for what that might look like and how we might protect our students and families and community. Hoping that we can move forward with a licensed school nurse back at the Department of Education again. We used to have that, and I think this is a critical time, especially with this pandemic, to have that collaboration and that expertise, understanding how education and health work together, especially during this pandemic. I am wondering if there might be an opportunity to partner with MDH or DHS or tap into some of those resources or support each other, collaborate, and figure out how to support our overall communities better. I think that licensed school nurses are doing a lot of public health right now for their communities and for their schools. We have the relationships with families. Perhaps that's an avenue for schools to recapture some of the money that is hard to find right now, but maybe with those supports that we are providing through the school setting to our community, maybe we could tap into some of those DHS resources and get reimbursed for some of that. I do think we have a great opportunity to make some changes right now, both from a health and educational perspective, and look forward to working with all of you and collaborating, and I am open to questions and suggestions and feedback as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Murren. We always appreciate creativity. Our last testifier today is Garrett Regan, president of the Minnesota School Bus Operators Association. Mr. Regan, please introduce yourself for the tape and proceed with your testimony. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, chairs and members. Pleased to be here. My name is Garrett Regan, president of Faribault Transportation and president of the Minnesota School Bus Operators Association. And as an industry, we are working very hard to be ready for the start of the school year this fall and to transport students safely. We met with MDE yesterday and the NSTA, which is the National Association for School Bus Operators. They are working on a comprehensive plan to allow safe transportation here in the fall. And we have already worked with the State Patrol, the CDC, and MDE to create our plan through MSBOA that we have put into effect with our members here this summer. So I believe that roadmap, the return to school roadmap, has been provided. If not, we are certainly able to pass that around for reference. However, some of the highlights in that program are taking drivers' temperatures, taking students' temperatures before entering the buses, making sure students are safe and drivers are safe as well and healthy to proceed on with the day. The cleaning of the buses daily after every route is suggested. There are many new technologies with fogging and other procedures utilized that are kind of cool to see the advancements there. A lot of our members are utilizing those technologies to be as efficient as we can, and again, as safe as we can to clean the buses and get ready for the next route. We talk about protective equipment, whether it's masks for students, gloves for drivers and students as well. Again, to as we see the data that masks are helping to slow or stop the spread, and a focus of ours here as well. There is a lot of talk currently about capacity on school buses and how many students we can allow on school buses safely. And the individual we had yesterday from the NSTA that's part of the task force kind of said it best, in my opinion, that when we focus a lot on just the number and how many students are allowed on a bus, we sort of lose the focus, which really is the health and safety of our students. There are a lot of pieces that go into that beyond just the number of students on a bus. So we focused on a lot of those details here. It might be easy to default to a number and because it's easy to measure and how many students we can allow on the bus. But we've focused on, in addition to that, a lot of the other protective equipment and cleaning and other details to keep students safe so that we are able to get as many students back in the classrooms as possible. And touch on social distancing in this return to school roadmap and separating seats when possible, putting family members together if possible, or individuals of the same household. However, we know that's not always possible, but it can be a focus for us as we move forward. Another piece to think about for capacity on school buses is just the efficiency and routing that many school bus companies put together. So buses are not at full capacity very often. Many of the buses do get to full capacity. However, that's right before they drop off at school. So it would be a rare case that a bus would be at full capacity for 30 minutes or even an hour. Typically, that would be more like 5 or 10 minutes where a bus would go out to the country or the outskirts of town, pick up a few number of students, and then get filled up as they get closer to the school. And as the bus is full, then it goes directly to the school to drop off and empty at that point. So naturally, for the efficiencies of routing in school bus companies, we are limiting the number of the time that students are on buses, which naturally helps with limiting interaction between students and the capacity. We've also tracked airline data. Obviously, they have been back implementing their policies, which has been nice for us to see and learn from. We have tracked the data as far as outbreaks, and we have not seen any outbreaks tied to travel that way. So we've been continuing to track that. Our members do have customers that are rolling again here this summer, such as the YMCAs, summer camps, of course, summer schools, business travels. That has been nice. We have found that our customers do feel comfortable, do feel safe, secure with a lot of our procedures. We've been able to learn from them. We've been able to get feedback from them and implement our procedures here at many of our different members' terminals. That has been helpful. So it's sort of a soft opening for the fall, if you will, that we can learn from and work to perfect and continue to perfect those sorts of details. That's been helpful for us. So in closing, we are confident as an association that we can be a benefit to returning the students to school. We don't want to be an obstacle, and we don't feel that we are. We feel that we've worked hard on these different procedures. We understand that in distance learning, a lot of professionals and experts have put a lot of time in perfecting the distance learning model or working to perfect it. And obviously there remain challenges due to the inequities and other obstacles that just remain just from having students not being in school. So we understand the importance of getting students back to school, and we are striving to work hard every single day to be part of that solution, to partner on that, to get the students back in school where they can hopefully learn best. And we are happy to answer questions today and be involved in the process moving forward. We appreciate the time here today. Thank you very much.
Mr. Regan, thank you for sharing your perspective and your industry's plans for the future. Much appreciated. Members, Mr. Regan closed out our list of testifiers. I'd like now to transition the virtual gavel to Chair Youakim for the member question portion of today's hearing. Chair Youakim.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you all for sharing your voices and your thoughts about how things went with distance learning and what you're thinking about going into the fall. I'm going to kick it off with the first question here. We have a lot of experience and education at the table and practical knowledge of how a classroom works. How many of your schools have been reaching out to teachers, social workers, school nurses, and et cetera, to help plan for the fall, to be part of those planning sessions? Just go ahead and help. I see, Christy McCoy.
We, across the state, first of all, the Minnesota School Social Work Association has been providing valuable professional development to help us get prepared to meet the increased demand hands of our students, but we also have been partnering with our teachers and staff as we're looking forward. The hard part is it's hard to know what to plan for, but we also have talked about what, again, the successes have been and what we might need to adjust and change if we go back full time into distance learning. So there has been significant partnership during this time.
Thank you. Any of the teachers have you been reached out to by your districts to help with planning? Maria Valencia.
Mm-hmm. Just yesterday, we had our first meeting with administrators and several teachers in different buildings to study the three possible ways that we would, the three possible models. And then we started conversations of what that would look like for our district and our specific schools. And just hearing all the different points of views of having different teachers and all kinds of staff members' voices of how will that look like and what we're going to do. We have three more meetings planned as we get closer to the fall. But not knowing which one will be is makes a big difference.
Anybody else have something quick to add, and then I'll go to member questions. Ms. Maria Lay.
Hi, we do have a committee that includes many diverse perspectives in our district in Roseville. However, in my opinion, we are a sounding board, and we have a committee above us, which is mostly administrators creating it, and we give feedback, but we're not included in the creation process, which has been a big concern. And as a teacher of color, bringing that perspective has been very crucial, and we have been trying to make it known. So not every single district is doing it the same way. It's nice that we're at least included for feedback, but they don't have to take our feedback, and they've made it clear that they don't have to take our feedback.
Thank you. That is disappointing. One more. Deb Muir, you have your hand up.
I was just going to say I'm lucky in that my school district is including me. I'm Rosemont Apple Valley Eagan, but there are, like I said, a lot of districts that don't have school nurses, and I worry that they lack that public health perspective while they make their plans. So I would put a plug in for nursing input on those plans. My district has been great, but I worry about those that don't have us.
Thank you so much. I've got some members with their names on the list right now, so we'll go to Representative Hewitt.
Thanks, Chair Joachim. And thank you, Chair Dabney, for this great meeting today. I do have a question for the wonderful nurse from 196 there. My question is, Deb, do you feel that you have, well, what I'm concerned about is the occupational health aspect of your job, as far as do you have what you need to also help staff, or is staff out of your reach as far as your scope of practice goes? Because I would imagine your scope centers around the students, but if you have to intervene with staff that's having something going on or a sickness or something, is that within your scope as a school nurse?
Ms. Muir.
Absolutely. Yes, we do support our school staff. We support, family members. We support whoever comes through our door. We are public health nurses first. Although we are employed in the educational setting, we support all those that come to us, and actually provided a lot of guidance, I think, across the state to families that did have sick family members or family members that were vulnerable. So yes, absolutely.
So did you have a follow-up?
One follow-up, Chair. So what I think it goes to point that scope does expand in some of our schools that aren't able to have public health nurses or even an RN on task. I can imagine a health tech does not have that discipline or that knowledge that you have to reach out to that, because they might be just passing whatever they're supposed to do or whatever. So I guess that's a concern to me as we go back to make sure that we do have adequate, probably licensed sources in the schools. So thank you.
Representative Jergen.
Thank you, Chair Joachim, Chair Dabney. My question is for Mr. Regan. As you might know, Garrett, the last several years I've gone to Hastings Bus Company for Bus Driver Appreciation Day and met some of the drivers. And while this doesn't include everyone, it's a bus driving job is a great retirement job. So a lot of the drivers are in that older, more vulnerable age group. Are you taking extra precautions to protect those drivers? And have you had some of those drivers who have indicated maybe unwilling to come back to work for that reason? And does that present different challenges, recruiting challenges to find bus drivers?
Mr. Reagan.
Sure. Thank you, Representative Juergens, for the question and the support over the years. Certainly much appreciated. We do have many school bus drivers in the older population across the state. It is a great retirement job, and that, in fact, leads to those in the a challenging class there being in the 65 or older potentially driving school buses. So right now we're focusing a lot on, of course, it's the student safety, but it's also driver safety as well, employee safety altogether. So that is a huge focus of what we do. It kind of all ties together, but it is a little bit separate. We have had some concern from our older population of drivers, maybe just communicating a little bit of uncertainties during these times and kind of wanting to hear more and see more. So that's obviously a big focal point of ours. But the protective equipment, the cleaning, the steps at the terminal level, not requiring drivers to physically come in and interact with each other as much as they did before, not requiring drivers to come in and physically receive route copies from dispatchers, rather just putting that in their bus seats, you know, just limiting that interaction, creating social distancing, and doing as much as we can that way, in addition to the cleaning and protective equipment that we'll be focusing on offering. And so the procedures we're putting into place now have been welcomed, and I think the vast majority are ready to get back going, but we are always focused on those who might be more concerned, and we're taking the feedback there and perfecting it as much as we can.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Katisa Batun.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So to all of you who have been able to join us today, I just wanted to express my gratitude for your work and for your flexibility and for keeping our students centered at the heart of all of your decisions. I represent Eden Prairie, and I'm a parent to almost four children. Ms. Mia Vicencio, thank you. It's nice to see you here today. And I'm also the vice chair of the Early Childhood Subdivision. So I wanted to inquire a little bit more, Ms. McCoy, if you could just share a little bit more detail about some of the adaptations that your program, the AGAPE program, might have had to make in order to support our teen parents as well as their children kind of throughout the distance learning process, and if there are other supports that potentially we could, you know, implement at the state level in order to make sure that those young mothers and young parents and our littlest Minnesotans are being supported as fully as possible.
Ms. McCoy.
Thank you for that question. You know, one of the things that we did do is we offered some, especially for our June grads, because they were dealing with a lot of grief. They have overcome so much, and they have worked really hard to get to the space of being able to graduate. So we offered a grief group. We also we're very fortunate. We have early childhood education that we partner with in our building. And our partnership with them also helped make sure that the students were able to not only manage their own emotional stress, but to think about how they can really work with their children, because they were so socially isolated and not able to leave and to do just things to take outside and just get fresh air. And it was just really overwhelming. And we did have some of our students who contracted COVID, and even though the babies had, a few babies had the similar virus, but there was concern about them even leaving their homes. And for a while, my district didn't allow me to have PPE to be able to go out to do home visits. And after George Floyd's death, that kind of then all shifted, because our students, it was putting them at risk and their children at risk to go out and use public transportation, to go to the grocery store, to get the things that they needed. So that's why it was really important that we were able to get donations. But I will tell you, a lot of the ways that worked was the partnerships that we have with public health. So we partner with Ramsey County public health nurses. And so we would spend and do virtual meetings with our students and their public health nurses and the teen parent social worker in the county. So I don't know if I have anything specific that I would ask for more support, but I will definitely get back with you as I ponder that a little bit further. But we really kind of did our best to go above and beyond to meet the social emotional needs of the students and to really support them in their parenting during this time. So
thank you. Representative Sindel.
Madam Chair and Chair Dabney as well, and to all the people who are testifying today for their terrific work and dedication to their children and their families. I'm really concerned about the issue of growing disparities among children and families who have less access to the technology necessary, less familiarity with the technology, and have, for a variety of reasons, been less engaged in their learning than they had in the past. I spoke to one of our superintendents yesterday, and she said that after the governor makes a recommendation in July about the way or ways that school districts may go back to work, there really only are 3 weeks left before they'll begin to see children. What do you expect we can do in order to reduce these inequities that may just grow in the future with the distance learning?
Who would like to take that? Ms. Lay, sorry, Ms. Lay.
I'm sorry, I think before I can answer that, can you restate the question one more time just to make sure I'm answering it correctly?
Sure.
With all Representative Sindel.
Well, thank you, Chair. Sure, you're okay. with all the obstacles that some families have during this period of distance learning, how is it that, and with such short time to make the changes and deal with the problems we face, what can we expect as far as dealing with these inequities and trying to overcome those obstacles? I'm very concerned about not only this year, but I have to say for a bit of the future.
Ms. Lay.
Yes, thank you very much for that. I'm going to speak from my personal opinion on what I believe that is best for my students. And like I shared in my testimony, my first job is to advocate for my most vulnerable students. And especially since I shared that there are many stakeholders involved, and unfortunately we are, as a teacher and with a committee, we're sounding board, but not included in the decision making. And what I would really like to see is inclusion of all stakeholders in the decision making, and that includes reaching out to our most marginalized groups in schools and school districts. We need to hear from the voices of our students, of our families, of our teachers who know our students, from our support professionals. They need to be at the decision making table and not as a sounding board. In order to have some of those inequities addressed, we need to have those tough conversations, and we need to be comfortable with doing things differently. And we need to understand that in a crisis, learning has to be different. Yes, there are standards. If there's any way that testing could be put aside, because there's no accurate way to measure even in a hybrid model, because school isn't the same. And we already knew that there's a lot of research that shows that testing doesn't work in a normal setting when we were going face to face. We just need to have a different model and really think human first. So any way that we can have individuals at the decision-making table and having these conversations, that is a start. Now, there's a lot of other things that can go into funding and in making sure that families that do not have what they need, whether or not it's technology or if it's hotspots or even access to internet, there's funding that obviously needs to happen there, and working with schools and school districts to make sure that they're meeting the needs of the families. But they need to be at the decision-making table first.
Thank you, Ms. Lay. Next, I have Representative, my brain just shut off. Representative Jordan.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I think I've been really struck by some of the words of Mr. Miletich when he talked about all of the different resources that would need to happen to make sure that we are keeping our environment and our custodial staff both safe and all of our other staff. And also, as we hear from all these, you know, younger child, earliest learner folks, what resources do you need to create a safe learning environment? We're not only just PPE, but when we think about story circles or social distancing on the bus, what resources do you need, both in terms of information, but supplies? I think there's going to need to be quite a bit of reimagining that happens. So what resources are missing right now that you think you need to get classrooms ready for even a hybrid learning situation in the fall? And I don't know who would like to take that one. And maybe people don't even have answers for that right now, but I don't know if maybe Ms. Lay.
I see Ms. Summers, did you have your hand up? Go ahead.
Yeah, I can take that. I have a little bit of a different perspective because our population is families with children birth through five. And it is challenging for toddlers to social distance. There's just, and so, you know, I think you're really grappling with what we're grappling with too. And as we are sort of awaiting the end of July announcement about what this will look like, it's a little harder to plan until we know that. But we're having to get creative about what in-person might look like for us. Until there's a vaccine, it's likely that parents of very small children will be concerned and just choose not to come in person. And so there's a lot around that. And I think what I would say we need at the top of our list as educators is a growth mindset, a willingness to see what we're working with and then work around that so that we're still meeting the need of the needs of learners, but doing it safely. And it's just tricky. I don't envy the top decision makers about this, but I think one thing I can say for certain is that we've had to be very flexible in how we're offering education and support. And that might be part of the technological trick, is tapping in where families are. So for us, we've utilized WhatsApp for family discussions. Many families that are new to country use WhatsApp to communicate with home. So we know that that is something they have access to. So a lot of this is thinking outside of the box with the safety of students in mind first. So I don't know if that really answered your question. I mean, I didn't mean to talk around it, but I think smaller class sizes for us might be part of the answer. We might be doing some outdoor classes and that sort of thing. So
I see Ms. Lay has her hand up as well.
Just kind of thinking very pie in the sky, we really need to get our community involved, because if we're thinking about some of the CDC recommendations of like 1 to 6 or 1 to 9, you can't do it physically within the school building. There simply is not enough room. But then really thinking, what are the basic needs that students need? And if we put SEL first, then any licensed teacher can help with that. But then we would need to see what other building space do we have? Can we utilize the church that's right across the street and then have it spread out so that we can have the space where a teacher could be 1 to 6? Because I can agree with young children, it's hard to keep them apart. But if we create a space where we can have that. And then again, you would also need transportation. It's a whole ripple effect, but how can we get the community involved to think creatively of how can we follow recommendations put forth by MDE and MDH to make sure that we are doing it properly? If this is put out by the state that you can only gather in groups of 10 or less, for example, whatever it may be, if there's another spike, what is the building capacity that we have? And especially for a school like mine, where we have majority of vulnerable students. Do we have access to busing where a school that is predominantly white, where a lot of their families have the means and access to work from home? Can we utilize those buildings, and will there be sufficient funding for buses to transfer kids there and then teachers? And then, so there's a lot of other things that need to be involved with that, but how can we get the community involved as well?
Thank you. We may have time for one more or two more questions here. We're trying to work that out. Representative Pryor.
So just any comments on any advice and guidance that you can give us on kind of what we can expect for how we're going to catch students up to this year. So we know that, you know, that it nobody could have planned on it, but it happened, and that schools and teachers did the best they could to put students in the best position possible that they could continue their education. But as you've told us, and we knew whether a student was disengaged or was having trouble with the technology, had trouble with being overwhelmed with the situation that they were in, and something that they, you know, the biggest thing that anybody could have happened in anybody's life, really, in so many ways. Students, you know, and I'm thinking this particular of those first grade students learning the basic skills for reading and what they missed out on. So just can you start giving us the picture now? Because, you know, we will be decision makers going forward. And we need to be grounded. We need a benchmark for what the challenges ahead of us to make it up to these students in the years going forward. So just any kind of qualitative discussion of what it is that we're looking at right now.
Who would like to take that? Ms. Villasencio?
Yeah, thank you. From a first grade perspective, I had most of my students were present. Most of them were completing the assignments that we had on there. They were taking, you know, for in the classroom, we are able to look and support students right on the spot. So an activity that for some takes 2 minutes, for some takes 20 minutes because of abilities or because of different reasons. Now online, I wasn't able to support my students. So it became either some of them became bored right away, or some of them were challenged and gave up right away. Either way, they were disengaged. There was disengagement by the end of the spring. So students and parents, they were pushed to the max, and teachers were pushed to the max. We tried doing assessments online, but again, trying to do it with a 6-year-old or a 7-year-old over a Zoom meeting, they were a lot of the times, I don't know how reliable those tests were, especially when family members were there or siblings were there wording it out or whispering the answer. And, you know, so it was a lot of, I don't know that we have the appropriate results. There were families that we were never ever able to reach, and students that were never able to participate. Even though we had one-on-one devices and we were trying our hardest to reach every student, and every staff member was trying, it wasn't just me, there were a ton of people trying to reach out for our students. So I don't know exactly what we're coming in the fall, but we did miss out in a lot of different experiences, especially as a young learner. We have hands-on field trips and activities that we constantly build in order to get them ready for the next level. And we missed out in too much. Like every time that I looked at my calendar, I'm like, oh, we would have been doing this, and how do I do that online? They've missed a lot. So we're actually planning and talking to like future leaders. How can we fill this void as we go forward? There are students that have no schema on certain things. And we tried building those for them for future, but we weren't able to appropriately. So it's hard for us to even know what's coming in the fall.
Thank you. Time for one more question, Representative Kunesh-Podi.
Good morning, everybody, and thank you for all your good hard work at the end of this school year and as you look ahead towards the next school year. For those of you who don't know, I am a teacher. I'm a library media specialist in a middle school in Robbinsdale, and kind of virtually went through that whole process of preparing for distance learning and getting technology into the hands of the students. And so one of my questions for the members that are active teachers right now and connected to it is, I guess I'm just curious to see what kind of a partnership you had with the specialists in your school towards meeting the needs of the kids, like the FIED teacher to help the kids stay active and keep their bodies healthy and moving and connecting with those teachers, because you know, that's always one of the favorite classes is gym. But also when it comes to technology, I'd be curious to see hear from you how your technology staff or your library media specialists, if you still have them, were partnering with you and what role they played in making sure that there was that continued connectivity. I just looked at my school email and I have 4 kids that are struggling with connecting to the internet, and I'll go in probably tomorrow and swap out their laptops so they have them through the summer. And I'm wondering what your feeling is around the technology partnership and the specialists in your schools.
Ms. Shepherd, you worked in a one-to-one program. Do you want to take that one on?
Sure, I could take that on. Sorry, I had to go pick up an order. That's why you saw me come back in with my mask on. It was very interesting for us because we all have laptops and iPads so that we can see what our students are also doing it from their perspective. So I was able to log on to Schoology and see, ooh, that works, or ooh, that didn't work. So let's try this a different way. A lot of our language arts teacher worked closely with the media specialist when it came to reading materials and different things like that. Our instructional coaches were very hands-on. We had a whole Schoology chat set up where we were just asking each other questions, because the new thing for us was actually presenting online. And so we used WebEx in Schoology conferencing, and we couldn't use any other format. So to keep it to that, and the Schoology conferencing was super difficult because what happens is it's on the website. It's not on the app that we give the kids. So we had to train the kids on how to get to that website in order to see the Schoology conferencing. And we found out different things, like if you don't lock your room and somebody else gets the code, guess what? You're going to get bombed with certain things. Yay, kids love to crack jokes even online. So we figured that one out. The thing I do want to mention is I think we definitely need to take into consideration screen time. And that's a discussion we really, really had in my district, because our kids would be able to get breaks from the screen when we were in person, whereas when we went online, it was overwhelming for so many of our kids. And the parents started talking to us about the fact, my kid's on 10 hours a day. Like, can we cut that down somehow? And being at the high school level, you have a little bit more flexibility on, okay, it really made me become a concise teacher even more than I already was. It's like, this is what we're focusing on. This is what you need to do, the end of it. And so that was also a little bit of a struggle, having that much screen time, because it's one thing to be on your phone on Snapchat. It's another thing to use that other side of your brain and be on that iPad consistently. So giving kids tips on how to take a break and then come back to it. And it's okay if you do that. So it was very, very helpful. Our tech guys also gave us different webinars that we could do just to come ask questions on how things worked. So we had access to that as well. And our elementaries use Seesaw, whereas the secondaries use Schoology. So when something would happen, we would be contacting each other. So we had a good network
in that. And I know every school's not going to have it. The new district I'm going to, I don't know what they have. So it's possible that I could lose some of that and have to figure things out a different way. But I think screen time is very important to keep in mind.
Well, personally, I can say we're excited to have you at St. Louis Park, Ms. Shepherd. So I know Ms. Smith wants to weigh in really quickly, if you can, and then we're going to have to wrap it up.
Thank you. I'm so glad Ms. Shepherd had brought up screen time because that's just such an important part of mental health and physical health to students. And working at an elementary school, Representative Kunish Pudin, we have a library media specialist who's also our art teacher. So she was doing double duty, so you can understand some of the struggles that she probably went through by both being the library media specialist along with the art teacher. One thing that we struggled with that I think we'll be looking at the beginning of next school year is that we kind of just scrambled and teachers used the format that they were most comfortable with, whether that was Schoology or Seesaw or Google Classroom. The struggle with that is we had parents who maybe have three children in elementary school, and now they're having to learn three different formats of connecting with teachers. And they might have their art teacher using one format, their regular classroom teacher using one format. And that is so frustrating for parents because for a lot of the students, I work in a district where the majority of our employers are, we have three prisons and a hospital and clinic in our community. And though that's a blessing because many of our parents continued working, it also meant that we had a lot of shift work going on. And so many of our students who were in elementary weren't working on homework until 6 or 7 at night, depending on what time their parents were coming home to be able to support them, help them log in. We were teaching children the day before distant learning how to log into their computers independently because we are a one-to-one school. And you can imagine as a library media specialist, that's challenging when you're teaching them the day before they leave how to do that. So from an elementary standpoint, just one thing we're going to be looking at and concerned about is trying to get everybody, all the teachers and all the specialists, using the same kind of format. Not only for the students, but also for the health of the parents.
Thank you, Ms. Smith. And I want to thank you all for being here today and sharing your stories and doing what you did to pivot to distance learning in the absolutely most challenging times. Our next meeting is going to be on June 30th at 9:45 a.m. And we're going to hear from school administrators, principals, superintendents, and the Minnesota Department of Education. Once again, thank you all for being here and have a great rest of the day. This meeting is adjourned.